Revising history is one of those things that our culture has a great tendency to do, isn't it? And a tendency to forget those events or situations which are not at all convenient for us to remember. So, for example, countless times during World War II, national days of prayer were called for, and huge drafts of people, many of whom would not normally bother to pray, stopped to pray over whatever particular disaster it was that was coming up, and God answered on a number of different occasions in the most wonderful and amazing way. And when you read the history books now, largely speaking, such events are excused as the stuff of fantasy and simply as wishful thinking and a political ploy to get people to think a certain way. The original intentions of authors is time and again ignored, which is why when it comes to America, there are all these different amendments to the American Constitution, because all the time they were debating whether or not the original writers would have meant it this way or that way. And it's crucial to understand what the original writers meant, because after all, they're the ones who had the ideas in the first place. You know, even in these days, the event of the Jewish Holocaust is now being questioned in some circles. And no doubt in 100 years from now, it and many, many other atrocities will simply be denied, properly denied. And so it goes on. We live in a world that is set to deny truth, or at least a world that has a view of truth, which means that your truth may be completely contradictory to my truth, but because I mean it sincerely and you mean it sincerely, both can be regarded as truth. Why is it that the world that we live in works so subjectively like that and treats truth and treats history and treats fact as if it's all up for grabs? Because that is the world in which we live. That's how it operates. And of course, the answer to why it is like that is because we live in a world that is broken. As the Lord Jesus said to the to people in his own time who were denying truth, "You belong to your father," he said, "the devil, and you want to carry out your father's desire. He was a murderer from the beginning, not holding on to the truth, for there is no truth in him. And when he lies, he speaks his native language, for he is a liar and the father of lies." We live in a world, we live in a culture that revises truth all the time. And if we're honest with ourselves, we often have a tendency as people to do just that as well, don't we? You think back over some event in your life, and we all tend to look at good things with rose-coloured spectacles, don't we? We tend to see bad things as black as they could be, and good things as wonderful as they can be. And yet the truth is often that the bad was maybe not as bad and the good was maybe not as good. And it's for this reason, when it comes to something as important about what God is like, that the Lord has built into salvation history what I can only describe as marker points. Or those of you that are computer literate will know that if you're using Windows XP, I've lost half the congregation already. If you're using Windows XP, then there is this thing called System Restore. Does this ring a bell for anybody? And System Restore is a wonderful thing, you know, because every so often your computer will set a marker point within its whole kind of makeup and settings and everything. And if you start going wrong from that point, you can, when the thing finally reaches scream point, go back to System Restore, and it will take everything that you've messed up and pull it all the way back to the point at which everything was going fine, and it will start over again. In just the same way, through salvation history, God hasn't made it so things can be brought back to, but God has made these security points, these marker posts, these flags that are flying, if you like, to which we may at least look back to double check that what seems to be happening is actually happening. Thus we get one in Genesis chapter 49. That is, if you like, the purpose. That's the first point. The purpose why this is here. And it is for this purpose that Jacob called all of his sons these tribal heads as they're going to be together. Here we come then to the final words of Jacob. And he is, just so we all remember, the father of the Jewish nation. His other name, of course, is Israel, meaning struggles with God. And as he speaks of what is going to pass, you can't get away from the fact that it is God who is going to bring these things to pass. God gets very little mention throughout this chapter, and yet he underlies everything that's going to happen for his honour and his glory, and the promises that he makes and has made are implied and underlying everything that Jacob has to say to his boys. As he speaks, therefore, of what God is about to bring to pass, he is a prophet as well as the father of the Jewish nation. We come to words which some people might argue as they read them are so ambiguous they could mean anything. And that's true, isn't it, of all sorts of secular prophecy. So the writings of so-and-so and the writings of so-and-so are written in such a way that actually you can get them to fit almost anything you want to. Some people would say that is what is happening here in Genesis chapter 49, that all of this is so vague and so woolly that actually it's pretty meaningless in the first place. But I hope that we're going to see, by the time we get to the end of this morning, that actually what is written down here under inspiration of the Holy Spirit is so precise and unmistakable that everything is meant in terms of fulfilling God's purposes for the world and fixing the brokenness that leads to us all having a tendency to revise in the first place. This is intended for us to refer back to and say, God is God. He meant what he said. Let's look through it together, and you'll see exactly what I mean, I think. Verse 1, let's just read this together to get ourselves bedded in the passage. Then Jacob called for his sons, and he said to them, "Gather round so that I can tell you what will happen to you in the days to come." What he's about to do with his sons is to look at what is both a personal revelation for them, but also, as the end of the chapter, verse 28 tells us, to give them a revelation of their tribal activities. In other words, what's going to happen to their families. And anybody that wants to say this is all vague and woolly and who knows whether this has taken place or not has got to remember that almost everything that he says to these boys that's going to come true for them, and in particular for the tribes that they will be the heads of, doesn't come true and isn't intended to come true until they reach the promised land, which is, Jacob knows, because Abraham was told, some 400 or 450 years away. If he had wanted to make it vague and woolly, he could have done that very easily. But it's rather like somebody in 1550 saying what's going to happen to his sons and their descendants and their descendants in the year 2000. And I think you'll see with me as we go through that he gets it pretty good. So that's the purpose of what's going on. Let's have a look at the promises or the predictions or the revelation as they go through. And we'll see how they go through. I propose to go through these one by one, but in brief, so that we can get the overall picture of what's going on. Here is Reuben. That's the first one he deals with in verse 3. And he's the eldest. And of course, within their culture, as within many cultures even today, the eldest is the one who always is the leader of the rest of the family. As Jacob puts it in verse 3, Reuben, you're my firstborn. You're my might, the first sign of my strength. You excel in honor and excel in power. He's built Reuben up so that there is such expectation, isn't there? As the head of the house, the one who will take over from Dad when finally Dad goes. Here is a man of great potential, somebody who could be greatly used. But you know the great problem with great potential, don't you? Great potential always brings with it great instability as well. And that's exactly what happened to this man. Excelling in power, but turbulent as the waters, you will no longer excel. This young man, as he grew up, earlier on in Genesis, in fact in chapter 35, had excelled in strength and in honor and in power, was the one who enjoyed all of the privileges of the family as the firstborn son. But he was so turbulent and so uncertain and so unpredictable that he'd used his power wrongly. Verse 4 continues, "For you went up to your father's bed, onto my couch, and you defiled it." Chapter 35 tells us that he slept with his father's servant girl wife Bilhah, who is in fact the mother of Dan and Naphtali. And his lack of loyalty and disgrace was seen throughout the tribe. And it showed, you see, not just a contempt for his father, but it showed also a contempt for God. And it set the structure, the history of the nation. They never occupied, this tribe of Reuben, they never occupied a position of authority ever again, always of heart searching. Whenever you see the tribe of Judah coming up again and again, as they're recorded in Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy and so on, you see Reuben is always the tribe that could but doesn't, maybe but falls back. The father had demonstrated what the rest were going to be like. Simeon and Levi, he says, were two brothers. Two brothers, if you remember as we went through it in chapter 34, who took great issue with the fact that the local inhabitants of Shechem had decided that their sister Dinah was up for grabs. And the local prince of Shechem had married her, taken her to be his wife. They took exception, and they went with their two swords and they butchered the entire town. And Dad describes them, "Simeon and Levi, your brothers, your two. Their swords are weapons of violence. Let me not enter their council. Let me not join in their assembly, for they've killed men in their anger and hamstrung oxen as they pleased. Cursed be their anger, so fierce, and their fury so cruel. I'll scatter them in Jacob and disperse them in Israel. These tribes likewise never had a portion in the promised land. Simeon was absorbed into Judah in the south and a little bit in the north. And Levi, well, Levi redeemed himself a bit in a rebellion, but never still possessed its own land. And justice is seen to be done." Now, before I go on into Judah and the rest of it, there's a part of me and a part of you that is saying, hang on a minute, this is all very well, isn't it? But actually, how can you possibly hold the rest of the tribe guilty for what their original fathers did? It would be like holding me responsible for what my dad did, for what my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather in 1600 did. That would be positively unfair, wouldn't it? Well, let's understand it in this sense, can we? Because everything else that follows here hangs on this point. God deals with people on two different levels, doesn't he? And we can see him doing it here. The two different levels are that God deals with people individually. Reuben deserved punishment. Simeon and Levi, as individuals, deserved punishment. He deals with people on two different levels. When you or I rebel against God, he deals with us as individuals. He punishes us individually. If we continue in our sin and rebellion against God and never bow the knee to Jesus Christ, then he will send us to hell individually, personally, knowingly, forever. But God also deals with us on another level, as peoples, as nations, in this case, as tribes. And we know that he does that because we see it in the Bible throughout, and we're seeing it here, as we've seen through the life of the account of Joseph. The great surprise is that God is taking this family group and dealing with them in such a way, the people of Israel, that the rest of the nations around them are blessed, the rest of the individuals around them are blessed. Why should God do that? Why should God deal with people both as individuals and as nations, as tribes, or as people groups, or as family groups? The answer is because God is God. And there are two things going on here. First, we're hearing in this chapter how he deals with the individual, Reuben, and Simeon, and Levi. And secondly, we're seeing, if you like, into the future, what will happen to the group of people, almost incidentally to what happened to their father. Reuben, you're my firstborn, he says. You went up to your father's bed and you defiled it. You personally will never excel. But actually, you're a picture of what's going to happen to your tribe as well. It will never excel. Simeon and Levi, you're butchers. You personally are to be feared and scattered and never to inherit. But you are an illustration, not a cause-effect. You are an illustration of what will happen to the tribes that follow you. Though one of you in fact, in the case of Levi, gets another privilege that is not mentioned here. You see the way it works. The great surprise of the whole story of this family is the surprise of what happened to Judah. Judah starts in Genesis 34 and slightly 35 and so on as a godless and rebellious and not caring, nasty individual. But he moves from godless avoidance to godly repentance as he leads the whole family into Egypt, as we saw in the chapter last week. His name, Judah, sounds like the Hebrew word for praise. And true to his name, he will be praised. But do you notice how the original dream of Joseph is transferred to Judah? Verse 8, just pick it up with me. Judah, he says, your brothers will praise you, and your hand will be on the neck of your enemies, and your father's sons will bow down to you. And now a sense of kingly rule is brought in, because as everyone knows, the lion is the king of the beasts. Verse 9, you're a lion's cub, O Judah. You return from the prey, my son. Like a lion, he crouches down and lies down. Like a lioness, who dares to rouse him? Then, verse 10, the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. What's happened to Judah as an individual, says Jacob, will happen to the tribe in the future en masse. Judah the individual turned from being godless and avoiding and horrible and rebellious and spiteful and nasty, and has been completely turned around to be the one who leads the others. So someday, one day, the tribe will be the tribe that leads the others. And here is the king. Here is the leader of his family and of his people, and it might take 400, in fact, even more days to come to pass, but it will come to pass. And in fact, in this case, not until the reign of King David does the promise come true, and then to Solomon, and then so on through the rest of the Old Testament, until verse 10, he comes to whom it belongs, and the obedience of the nations with his. You see, having dealt with the reprobates of Reuben and Simeon and Levi, Jacob is holding out a promise. Remember, you see, that this whole family, this whole thing is underlined, as I said, by the promises of God. And the promise of God to the world was made in Genesis chapter 3, that one day, someday, a rescuer would come. And in chapter 12, through this family, just turn back with me to chapter 12 and verse 1. To Jacob's grandfather, Abraham, and his father Isaac, and to him, I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you, 12 verse 1, verse 2. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. Judah and his tribe will rule, says Jacob, until the ruler comes, that is, until he comes to whom it belongs, and the obedience of the nations is his. And how is that ruler described? Well, verse 11, he'll tether his donkey to a vine, his colt to the choicest branch. Think of Palm Sunday. Think of somebody who was involved with a donkey that was tied to a choicest branch, waiting for for it to be written. Think of the one of whom it was said, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." Think of the one of whom it was cried, "Blessed is the coming kingdom of our father David." Think of the one who could truly be called the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Think of the one who is described as the Son of David. Think of the one who is called in Revelation the Lion of the tribe of Judah. And you'll see Jesus. And it will be a time of plenty when he comes. Because verse 11 continues, he'll wash his garments in wine. Nobody, unless they're very rich, does things like that. And his robes in the blood of grapes. And his eyes will be darker than wine, and his teeth whiter than milk. There's so much wrapped up in that imagery that I can't begin to unpack it in great detail. But here is Jacob, the promise bearer, Israel, who struggles with God, who's been looking for a better country, and he sat up, and in his dying breath, he points out his sons who will rebel and how bad they are and what will happen to those that follow. And right in the middle, right at the culmination, if you like, he takes this son Judah, who has been the rebel, who's been brought back to God, and is now ruling the rest of his brothers, and says, "Through you, the promise of God to the whole world will be kept. Through you, some way, somehow, God will make this king rule." And from that vision, everything else follows. Indeed, every other one of the boys somehow is subservient. Verse 12, Zebulun means to dwell. And whilst he never dwelt on the coast, if you cast your eye down, verse 13, he did trade with Sidon, which is on the coast, and his whole trade was the whole tribe's trade was dependent on that. Issachar, well, it was actually Zebulun's deposed older brother. And he was burdened rather too much, if you read the sense of it, with material prosperity. When he sees how good is his resting place and how present is his land, he'll bend his shoulder to the burden and submit to forced labor. In other words, he's more interested in being rich than he cares how hard he has to work. Dan's the smallest tribe, and his name and his intention was for him to be fearsome in justice. And you see that when you look at some of his descendants, people like Samson, who was fearsome in justice, but sadly so. And he fell from his calling in Judges 18 and the terrible events that took place. And as you see the picture being painted by Jacob, as he says what's going to happen to this tribe and to the rest of the tribes, he cries out in verse 18, "I look for your deliverance, O Lord. Gad's going to be famous for military might and join David and his men when it really counted. Asher, well, that tribe was prosperous and had a prosperous part of the land to the point of the coming of the king. Naphtali was a people of the mountains and will enjoy the freedom of the mountain people. And Joseph, well, Joseph is the one who seems to have the majority of the blessings on his side. Running from the present to the past to the far future. This is the man who is, it says, a fruitful vine," verse 22, "a fruitful vine near a spring whose branches climb over a wall. This is a man whose past experience was bitter," verse 23. "With bitterness, archers attacked him and they shot at him with hostility. This is a man whose fortitude and faith remained strong in the Lord," verse 24. "But his bow remained steady and his strong arm stayed supple because of the mighty hand of the one, because of the hand of the mighty one of Jacob and because of the shepherd, the rock of Israel. And this is the one," says Jacob, "who will know great blessing in the future because of your father's God who helps you, because the Almighty who blesses you with blessings of the heavens above and blessings of the deep that lies below, blessings of the breast and of the womb. Your father's blessings are greater than the blessings of all the ancient mountains, than the bounty of the age-old hills. Let all these rest on the head of Joseph, on the brow of the prince among his brothers." That last phrase, "prince among his brothers," is translated elsewhere as "separate from his brothers." And it's the phrase that's later used of a Nazarite that was set apart for God. And last of all, little Benjamin. Verse 27. Little Benjamin. The apple of Dad's eye. The little boy who Dad would never let out of his sight and who was always kept close to dad's apron strings, if you're allowed to use that phrase. Little Benjamin, the one who dad was so worried about, would grow up to be, and the tribe would grow up to be, a ravenous wolf, a malevolent group of people. In the morning he devours the prey, and in the evening he divides the plunder. What on earth is all of this for? Why is it, apart from giving a sort of marker post, why is it that the Bible has bothered to record for us all of this detail about all of these tribes? We could have looked in excruciating detail about how the intricacies of what happened to Simeon came true. And we could easily have gone into the detail further of just how it was that Dan was supposed to provide justice and didn't, and so on and so on. We could easily take weeks and weeks and weeks over this. I'm not going to do that, because I want us to get not just the promises, but the point. You see, the point of all these blessings, all these revelations, is that, as I've said already, they were seen to come true in the history of God's people. And later, in fact, than they could have been written down. This Genesis and Exodus, Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy were all written by Moses. They're called the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. And we know, because it's generally regarded in amongst biblical scholars, that they were written by Moses. Indeed, Jesus calls them, as shorthand, the books of Moses. And Moses, of course, had already died before the people entered the promised land. So he couldn't have known what these tribes were going to be like. He may have mixed with them as they were in the desert, but he couldn't have known, for example, that Zebulun was going to be by the sea or not. He couldn't have known how the land was going to be portioned up, because it was his successor, Joshua, who portioned out the land with the people. So what is the point of all of this being written down? Why has God, under inspiration of the Holy Spirit, bothered to give us all this detail? What is, in particular, the message to you and me this morning? Well, it's all very interesting, you see. But quite honestly, and I can hear some of us thinking it, it's all very interesting, but frankly, I didn't come through a frosty morning to find out why it is God promised people 4,000 years ago something that was going to come true 3,000 years ago. I mean, you know, it's all very interesting, but I could have stayed at home and read this and been just as confused by it. Why has God bothered to write this down for us? And the answer, of course, lies in what this tells us about God. You can't have noticed, if you've been with us for some time, you can't have helped but notice that this idea of what God is like keeps on coming up through this book of Genesis. And that is because God wants us to grasp what he's like. Right at the beginning of his introduction of the revelation of himself, he wants to take us, as it were, by the head and shake us and say, look at what I'm like. Understand who I am. Understand how it is I behave. Because only when you understand how I behave will you be able to treat me rightly and respond to me rightly. God always does, even far into the future, what he says. Always. We've seen it time and again through Genesis. And we're seeing it again now, only on a macro scale, kind of blown up and exploded into the rest of the Bible, but done in such a way that we can come back and tick them off as we go. Folks, we may feel that this world in which we live is out of control. And for some of us, even this week, I know that there have been things that have happened where, quite honestly, it feels as if we live in chaos and as though nobody is in control and everything is going wrong. You switch on the news last night and you see yet again there are people blowing themselves up. It's almost endemic in Iraq now, isn't it? You, You stop being shocked by the fact that yet another car bomb has gone off and yet more people have been blown into eternity. And all around us, all the time, there are people dying. And there is redundancy and there is uncertainty and nobody quite knows what's going on. And it feels as if the world we live in has gone out of control. But the message of Genesis 49, as actually the message of the whole of the book of Genesis to us more than anything else, is that the world is not out of control. It is completely and totally and securely under his control. That's the point. That's what we're supposed to grasp. That is why, the light in which we are supposed to live. God knows what will happen in the future, and it's all totally in his grip. I have a friend who writes to me from time to time, and he often finds himself in ludicrously dangerous situations, and he always signs himself off, "in his grip." You're a Christian this morning, then all of us can write, no matter what is happening, and sign ourselves off, "in his grip." Can I say that even if you are not a Christian this morning, you may not think you are in his grip, but he is God. And actually, one way or another, you are. What makes all of this picture that's painted by Jacob to his sons so vital for you and me this morning is, as we focus in again on what is happening to the great turnaround one, Judah, and the news of the one to whom the nations will all one day come, and to whom the obedience of the nations will one day be seen. I said already, haven't I, that God deals with people on two levels. First, an individual level, and also on a national, on a group level, on the level of nations, on the level of tribes. You know, in all the busyness and the paganism of Egypt, these people may have felt isolated and completely ridiculous and alone, but they were told what was going to happen. Imagine for a moment how they would have felt. They'd left their ancestral land. That hadn't been ancestral for very long. It had only been ancestral for three generations. And they'd gone to Egypt because there was a great famine. But remember, God had said there was going to be a great famine. And God had made arrangements for Joseph to be there to make sure there was food for them and for everybody else. As he said, and as we'll see he says in chapter 15 next week. And people are worshipping the sun god and ignoring the God who has blessed them so richly. And people are worshipping the cat god. And people are worshipping Pharaoh. And here is this little group, this isolated group of shepherds. And remember, we saw in a couple of weeks ago that all shepherds, or two or three weeks ago, all shepherds are detestable to Egyptians. So there's this isolated group with all the sheep around them, and nobody wants to know them, and everybody thinks they're crazy, and they don't worship the sun god, and they don't worship the cat god, and they don't worship Pharaoh. And in the midst of it all, as everybody else is living it up and getting on with being Egyptians and building pyramids or whatever it is they did, they hadn't built the pyramids at this point, and whatever it is else it is they did, they may have felt ridiculous and alone, but Jacob had no hesitation in telling them that God was God, and one day there would be a ruler that came from his son Judah to whom all the nations would bow. In the busyness of the world in which we live, we may at times feel, as Christians, isolated and ridiculous and alone. All of us have felt that from time to time. And frankly, sometimes we look it, even if we don't always feel it. But we can know for certain that the Bible is clear that God is God. And we are neither isolated, nor ridiculous, nor alone. And in fact, it is the world around us that hasn't the foggiest idea what is going on. Just look with me at the end of the Bible for a moment, at Revelation chapter 5, will you? Page 872, if you're using one of these Bibles. Remember what Jacob had said to his son about how the nations would bow? Verse 5 of Revelation 5. Actually, let's read from verse 1. Then I saw, says John, in the right hand of him who sat on the throne, a scroll with writing on both sides and sealed on with seven seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming in a loud voice, "Who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll?" But no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth could be found to open the scroll or even look inside it. I wept because no one was found who was worthy to open the scroll. Then one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, he has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals." And then I saw, this is the lion apparently, then I saw a lamb, looking as if it had been slain, standing in the center of the throne, encircled by the four living creatures and the elders. He had seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent into all the earth. And he came and he took the scroll from the right hand of him who sat on the throne. And when he had taken it, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb. And each one had a harp, and they were holding golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And they sang a new song. And they sang, "You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, because you were slain, and with your blood you purchased men for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. And you have made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth." And then I looked and heard the voice of many angels, numbering thousands upon thousands and 10,000 times 10,000. And they encircled the throne and the living creatures and the elders, and in a loud voice they sang, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise." Then I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and on the sea and all that is in them. Think about that phrase before we see what the creature said. Every creature, every ant, every horse, your next door neighbor, the person that mocked you the other day when you said you were a Christian in the supermarket, the person at work who makes digs at you because they know that you won't join in the lottery. Every creature singing to him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb, be praise and honor and glory and power forever and ever. And the four living creatures said, "Amen." And the elders fell down and worshipped. And God says to you and me, from Genesis chapter 49 this morning, that will happen